So our job is to, one of our jobs is to monitor the state of our mind and to discern virtue from non-virtue. And that's, you would think that would be quite easy, but sometimes our mind gets very clouded and we can't see that so clearly. So, for example, we may do one action and then afterwards question ourselves, like, oh, gee, maybe I acted in a very self-centered way. When I did that, I had a lot of attachment. Maybe I should have done it differently. So we start worrying like that. And then our mind flips to kind of justifying what we did. Well, no, it wasn't really that, wasn't really selfish. What I said, what I did was quite reasonable. Anybody would have done that. So why am I getting down on myself? But then inside you feel, well, no, maybe I was kind of selfish. And then you go back and forth between justifying it and then feeling guilty. We could spend quite a long time on that, actually. Meanwhile, life is going on. Sentient beings are in samsara. And we're ruminating and twirling. So it's very helpful sometimes when we can't see what's going on in our mind so clearly to put it down for a while, realize that the guilt is not a virtuous mind, and the justification also isn't a virtuous mind. And so let's put it down and then try and think, well, what is a reasonable attitude? What is reasonable behavior? But not to pressure ourselves to come to a conclusion right away, but let there be some space in the mind. And in the meantime, get on with virtuous activities. And so, of course, our primary virtuous activity is continually bringing the mind back to bodhicitta, even if it's contrived, even if it's effortful, even if we feel like we have to drag ourselves there. Because the more we do it and the more we become familiar with it, the more joyous it is, the more natural it becomes. And to the point where, you know, we say, well, what else would I do with my life? And then we just settle into the bodhicitta and the bodhisattva's activities. So tonight, listening to all the debating things, that's, if we have bodhicitta, then that becomes one of the bodhisattva activities. And so let's do that and add some more drops to that bucket of merit that will one day ripen in our having spontaneous, effortless bodhicitta. So that state of mind that I was talking about, do any of you have that? You kind of go back and forth between feeling guilty and also justifying what you did. But you don't really believe the guilt, and you don't really believe the justification, and you're really not sure what's going on. Yeah. It's amazing how we get so tangled up, isn't it? So I really see when my mind gets to that, I just have to, you know, okay, let's put this down, bring the mind back to something that I know is virtuous, and stop, because all that ruminating actually becomes quite self-centered, you know? I'm so guilty. Look, I did something so selfish. I should have done something else. But it wasn't so bad. It's okay. The other person survived. Everybody else would have acted the same way. I'm really not a disaster. And so, do you see, everything comes around back to me, you know? And meanwhile, the other person's kind of completely forgotten about what the situation is. And the other people around us probably didn't even notice it. And meanwhile, we're just, stuck. Amazing, isn't it? What our mind does? We can spend a long time on that. Was that virtuous? Was that non-virtuous? I don't know. I'm guilty. No, I'm not guilty. Me. I. Okay, so if I can change the subject away from me and I to something a little bit more boring, like the debate text, you know, which talks about form and consciousness and abstract composites and asks us to classify things and figure out, you know, sounds that are concordant with, a sound made from the elements that coming from, you know, with an elision. Yeah, conjoined with consciousness and other sounds. Anyway, okay, so I wanted to start tonight because Stephen wrote quite an interesting email. So he was saying it revolves a question from when we were talking about abstract composites a couple of weeks ago. So he said, you had suggested that it would be helpful to start trying to categorize objects in our daily life as a way to develop mindfulness, increase our wisdom, and decrease our disturbing conceptions. Yeah. Didn't anybody do that besides Stephen? Oh, yeah, you did it? Uh-huh.
Back then, I can't remember it right now.
Oh, okay, yeah. So we do it for a day or two. Or an hour or two, and then forget it. Okay, anyway, he said, I started doing this while on a run recently in the woods. Okay, so not instead of, you know, playing his iPod, then he was doing this. So he said, it was easy to understand that rocks, dirts, plants, and trees are all matter. Okay, however, it was very interesting to think about the trail that I was running along. To me, this trail was imputed on the absence of vegetation and trees. I could not point to the dirt or rocks on the trail and say that those were the trail. Therefore, it seemed that the trail was an abstract composite, maybe a continuity or order. This then made me question if all phenomena that were imputed on the absence of something would be abstract composites. Let's start with the first part of that. So what do you think the trail is? Do you think it's an abstract composite? What, you know, he said, you know, it's imputed. You know, actually he's looking at it more from a Prasangika view, but it's more because in this school, imputed, yeah, means that in order to know the object, you have to see something else first. Okay, so imputed has a different meaning than it does in Prasangika. Yeah, so to know the trail, what is it? Is it an absence of vegetation and plants? And that's what makes something a trail? But absences are usually permanent phenomena. Is the trail a permanent phenomena? It's not permanent, is it? But do you think, what do you think the trail is? Do you think it's form? Do you think it's consciousness? Or do you think it's an abstract phenomena? I think we can all agree it's not consciousness. okay, then what do you think it is? What would you say to Stephen? You think it's an abstract composite? Why?
Because it's neither just form and it's not consciousness. It's an idea of something based, designated in terms of...
The trail is an idea? Well, you're running on an idea?
No.
Yeah, it's form, isn't it?
It's an area.
Yeah. Do you think it's area or do you think it's form? There's the trail.
It's form.
Okay. We see it. We touch it. Yeah. So it's not an abstract composite where you have to see some other thing to know, like the person, you know, to identify the person. You have to either know the body, speech, or mind to know that the person's there. But to know there's a trail, you can open your eyes and see it, can't you? Okay? So I think what he was doing is he was getting the meaning of imputed mixed up from how this school talks about it and how Prasangikas talk about it. Okay? Because he said, then it made me question if all phenomena that were imputed on the absence of something would be abstract composites. But is a trail imputed on the absence of plants and so on? Like Venerable Tarpa said, the moon doesn't has an absence of plants and rocks, or, you know, plants anyway, vegetation, but we don't call that a trail. So what's... If we go to the Prasangika way of talking about imputation, what's the basis of imputation of the trail? Dirt, isn't it? Yeah, dirt, you know, that is cleared away so that people can walk on it and it can perform the function. So that's, you know, that dirt would be the basis of imputation according to the Prasangika meaning of imputation. Okay, according to the Satantrika, yeah, the trail would, and according to the Prasangika, the trail would just be form. Yeah? Don't you think? Okay. So he said, I'll read the rest of the email. Then the dividing line between matter and abstract composites becomes quite vague. Aren't we always pointing to something else that is not the imputed object? So, you know, I'll keep reading. If everything is imputed in dependence on something else, what is the distinction between matter and abstract composites? So here again, we have to see that there's a difference in the meaning of imputed. Okay? From the Prasangika view, everything exists by being merely imputed, independence upon something else that is not it. Okay? So the trail's imputed on the rocks and the dirt that covers a certain area. Okay? The table is imputed independence upon the legs and the tabletop and, you know, like that. So that's when we're talking about the basis of imputation and the imputed object, and how Prasangika say that phenomena exist, and they say everything is imputed. Okay? But the Sautantrikas don't say everything's imputed. Yeah? They say functional things are all substantially existent. Remember? Okay, so functional things are substantially existent. Permanent things are imputedly existent. But then they also have this other way of meaning imputedly existent, where that is applied to the abstract phenomena. So Satantrika is quite confusing. They kind of have two ways of using substantial and imputed existent.
I'm not rocking this, to tell you the truth.
Uh-huh.
So it's hard for me to call that trail a form. Because uh-huh. If a form was just a color and a shape, why wouldn't your foot go right through it doesn't have to be a tangible object. Seems like you'd fall right in it.
This is actually one of the, it points to one of the difficulties that at least I have with some of this, is they say that form is color and shape. Okay. And then they would probably say that the trail would be a tangible object because it's hardness. Okay. But actually, you don't it gets dicey. Do you apprehend, if you investigate to tantrika, do you apprehend the trail with your tangible touch consciousness, body consciousness, or do you apprehend the hardness? Yeah. So it's always confused me about Satantrika, how they say that, you know, I see the carpet, but actually we're seeing the blue color of the carpet and we're feeling the softness and the texture of the carpet. Okay. But they say, you know, that we have to somehow, remember we read about this a few weeks ago, you know, and how some people would just put all these in the category of tangible objects, and then some people would categorize them according to the main sense that you saw them. Yeah. So anyway, this is, I don't know. Okay. So that's one of the problems I find with this system. Okay. But maybe for a Satantrika, it makes perfect sense. And I think for a Satantrika, you're going much more on just how normal people would see things. And normal people would not see the trail as something imputed. You know, they might see the person as something imputed. Yeah, in the sense that you can't actually see the person, you know. You see the body or you hear the voice or something. But regular people, I don't think would see the trail as imputed. They would say, I see it with my eyes and I feel it with my feet. Yeah, so Vaibhasika and Satantrika are going much more along with just our ordinary perceptions.
Yeah, so this school does talk about merely imputed permanent phenomena. Mm-hmm. One of the synonyms is generally characterized phenomena.
Yeah, and because they
those are merely imputed thought. Whereas, so all permanent phenomena are merely imputed, but a person, I don't know about all other composites, but a person is said to be imputed.
Imputed, yeah.
I don't know if other abstract composites are also said to be imputed, but not merely
imputed. Merely imputed, yeah. And you can see the difference there because merely imputed for them really means that you're making it up by your mind. Whereas a person, we don't consider we're making it up by our mind. So it's imputed in a different sense. Yeah? Is that what you're pointing out? Imputed and merely imputed, yeah. Okay. Although sometimes I wonder the way he speaks, if that's a technical term in Satantrika or if that's his way of expressing it. I'm not, Dan Perdue's ways of expressing it. It makes sense, you know, because for them, you know, permanent phenomena, really, it's just things you're creating with your own mind by giving things names. I mean, that's how they see things like that.
I wonder if some of this comes back to the way the Buddha described the person being this collection of heaps or this aggregation of heaps.
Mm-hmm. Or dependent on the collection.
Yeah, and even the definition, I don't know where that comes from, but the person is being imputed in dependence upon the aggregates, any of the five aggregates. So I wonder if some of that understanding is coming from how the Buddha described certain things, how they interpret what he said about this.
Yeah, because it seems like maybe those people back then had much more of a sense of the person as being imputed. I'm always puzzled. The person is imputed? no, it's not. You know, my mind has some reaction. No, it's more. There's something else.
I think I just searched merely imputed in his book, and it comes up six times, and comes up once in a definition.
Oh.
So if it's in a definition, I think it's probably
thinking
about it. It's in the definition of specifically characterized phenomena as a phenomena that is established by way of its own character without being merely imputed.
Yeah.
By term or thought consciousness. And it's probably in another one, but I just didn't. No. It is generally too.
Generally,
yeah. So since they're in the definitions,
too.
I think he probably was paying attention because every word
it would
matter.
It would be a specific term. Okay. Okay. So let's go back to where we were with proving mutual inclusion. But I think, you know, I want to comment that what Stephen's doing is very good. You know, that's exactly what we should be doing as we walk around and look at all these things. And, you know, we went over all these different classifications of phenomena and asking ourselves what is what? Yeah. And in that way, making ourselves familiar with things. Mm-hmm. Okay, so proving mutual inclusion. There are two points to touch on to prove that two phenomena are mutually inclusive. First, as in the case of mutually exclusive, you must show that the two are different. For all the comparisons, the two principles must be different. Okay? And remember, to be different, they have to be existent. Yeah? Again, this entails that... That's the next sentence. Again, this entails that they must be existent, but not identical. Otherwise, one might say that a pot and a pot are mutually inclusive, or that the horn of a rabbit and the ruling king of France are mutually inclusive. There is no separate paradigm for proving that two phenomena are mutually inclusive without anything that is neither, because the system does not set that off as a separate case. Don't ask why. So the answer in the debate, the two, P and Q, are mutually inclusive. The subjects P and Q are different because of being phenomena that are diverse. And then two, the subjects P and Q have all eight approaches of pervasion. So I'm going to keep reading here so that we can look at all of these eight. So the second requirement is that the two principles must have all eight approaches of pervasion. These are, whatever is a P is necessarily a Q. Whatever is a Q is necessarily a P. Sounds good. Whatever is not a P is necessarily not a Q. And whatever is not a Q is necessarily not a P. Sounds reasonable. If there is a P, then there is necessarily a Q. And if there is a Q, there is necessarily a P. And if there is not a P, then there is necessarily not a Q. And that if there is not a Q, then there is necessarily not a P. So you have to have all eight of those for something to be mutually inclusive. So, like he says, it seems that if the first two pervasions were true for any P and Q, then the remaining six would also have to be true. So why is the debate done this way? Good question, isn't it? And then he gives some ideas. It may be that it is difficult to prove a pervasion as opposed to proving a lack of pervasion, as in the case of mutually exclusive phenomena, except by substituting other mutually inclusive things in the place of the principles. For instance, why is it true that whatever is an impermanent phenomenon is necessarily a functioning thing? Okay. One reason is because they are mutually inclusive. But if that is what you're trying to prove, that won't work as your reason. So we might say, because whatever is an impermanent phenomena is necessarily momentary, and whatever is a functioning thing is also necessarily momentary. Okay? And that makes sense. Both of those statements are true. So those pervasions and that reason and the reason as a whole are accurate. But that reason doesn't work either. Yeah. For instance, it is true that whatever is an impermanent phenomenon is necessarily inexistent, and that whatever is a permanent phenomena is necessarily existent and existent. But by no means does that prove that whatever is an impermanent phenomena is necessarily a permanent phenomena. Okay? So you're understanding that? So it's, yeah, if you did Venn diagrams in school, it's kind of easy, makes it easier. Okay. Yeah, so another example would be, Maitri is a cat at the Abbey and Karuna is a cat at the Abbey, but that doesn't mean Maitri is Karuna. Okay, so that would be another example. So this may be the reason that the paradigm requires the defender to list the eight approaches of privation. Another possible reason is so that the speaker learns all the implications of mutual inclusion. The situation is different when proving that two different phenomena are mutually exclusive, for that can be done by stating a couple of privations linking the two principles to other mutually exclusive phenomena. Okay, then the fifth through the eighth approaches of privation, beginning with the statement, if there is a P, then there is necessarily a Q, okay, reflects the exist mode of statement. So that's starting with number five of the eight. So recall the two types of modes of statements specified in the definition of the property of the subject in chapter 6. Okay, so remember there were is statements and exist statements. Yeah. So the is mode of statement says something about the manner of being a P and a Q in the privation. If something is a P, then that thing is a Q. Okay, so if something is food, it must be edible. The exist mode of statement says something about the existence of something. The existence or presence of one thing shows the existence or presence of the other as well, because they are just different names for the same thing. If there is a P, then there is necessarily a Q. Now, is that always the case in an exist statement? If a P exists, then a Q exists. Another possible way of saying this is wherever there is a P, there is a Q. Yeah, this is not meant to say something about location of a thing, or to suggest that everything is physical, but that if a P is anywhere, then that proves that there is a Q at the same place. So my question is, yeah, and I'm asking you this, is that privation, okay, number five of the eight, is that one sufficient enough to prove that two things are mutually inclusive? That if there is a P, there is a Q.
No, because it doesn't show privation in both directions.
Let's do both statements. If there is a P, there is a Q, and if there is a Q, there is a P. Okay, do those two together, just those two, always work to... Would they work to prove mutual inclusion? So it would be five and six together. Just like one and two together would prove mutual inclusion, would five and six together prove mutual inclusion just by themselves?
It seems like it.
Well, the problem I see is that there could be things that were causal in this. I don't know if it would necessarily work. Like if you do the, like if there's smoke and there's necessarily fire, if there's fire, then there's necessarily smoke. No, they aren't.
Yeah.
But that's what I was thinking about. It's like, it seems like that this in itself, okay, well, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, that makes sense because the form wouldn't hold. You know, my question is that form by itself sufficient to prove mutual inclusion? Because it would seem like one and two would be sufficient by themselves to prove mutual inclusion. Mm-hmm. So I'm asking if five and six are two, wouldn't they be? And she just gave an example of how they're not.
Except for that, the second one doesn't quite work. You know, that five works, but six doesn't for that.
If there's smoke, there's fire, but if there's fire, there's smoke.
Yeah, if there's smoke, there's necessarily fire. But if there's fire...
What about the last... I wonder about that one, because what about the last moment of the fire? The fire goes out, there's still smoke.
Another pair that wouldn't work is the basis of designation of something and the designated object. Or the emptiness of something and the object.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because those things, especially like if it's if there's a conventional truth, there's necessarily an ultimate truth. If there's an ultimate truth, there's necessarily a conventional truth. But that doesn't mean conventional truth and ultimate truth are mutually inclusive. Okay, so five and six alone wouldn't work.
So something could be, two things could be of the same nature and they would fit into that, but they wouldn't be mutually
inclusive. Right.
Or you could have a parent and a child.
Uh-huh.
They wouldn't be a parent if there's not a child.
Right.
They wouldn't be a child if there's not a parent, but they're not mutually inclusive.
Yeah. I was just seeing if I could trip you up. Of course, however the statements are expressed, it is clear that the P and the Q refer to just the same thing in the world. That has to be, that's necessary in order for there to be mutual inclusion. And that the thing is being characterized differently as a P and as a Q. Okay. So this is the essence of mutual inclusion, that the two phenomena are just different names for the same thing, as every impermanent phenomenon is also a functioning thing. And if there is an impermanent phenomenon, then the existence of that impermanent phenomena shows that there is a functioning thing. Okay, so you have, for that, for mutual inclusive, you have the is, the is, and the exists. Okay, so exercise 11.1. Ooh, working with your debate partner or by yourself. So we'll do this as a group, or maybe we can. You wanted to go into debate partners and see if you can do it. That might be good. Okay. Answer the following comparisons of phenomena and prove them according to the paradigms. Try to do them verbally and run through them a couple of times to put them in your mind. You can find the answers to all of these in this book somewhere. In forging a good syllogism, you may want to review the advice at the end of chapter 6. Okay, you know, can you grab a partner, the person sitting next to you or behind you or... find somebody? Okay. Yeah. People who haven't attended the class for a long time, don't worry about it because it's confusing. Okay. See. Okay. So take a couple of minutes and let's do the first one. How do the selfless and objects of knowledge compare? That's nice when you're into it, huh? Yeah. Shall we do one together? Okay. So how about established bases and phenomena that are non-things?
Six.
Number six.
Okay, there is an example of something that is both.
And established. You have to say that they're neither, that you have to differentiate.
Okay, established bases and phenomena that are non-things are three possibilities with neither
But you have to say that they're different phenomena first.
Oh, they are different phenomena because they are diverse.
Yeah.
There are three possibilities. An example of something that is both an established base and a phenomenon that is a non-thing is the absence of Donald Trump in this room. So it is an established base because it's established by valid cognition. And it's a phenomenon that is a non-thing because it's a permanent phenomenon. Okay, then an example of something that is an established base but not a phenomenon that is a non-thing is Donald Trump. So it's an established base because it's established by valid cognition. It's not a phenomenon that is not a non-thing because it's a impermanent phenomena. And there is nothing that is a phenomenon that's a non-thing, but not an established base. But there is something that is neither of those two, and that is a ruling king of America.
Are you sure that's not an existent?
Yes, I'm sure.
Just wait till next year.
Or tomorrow.
Or another example, an angry Buddha.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think that's an example of something that doesn't exist.
That
an angry Buddha?
Yeah. Okay. Now what are you protesting?
You said that there's not a phenomena that's a non-thing.
There's nothing which is a phenomenon that's a non-thing, but it's not an established base. Because phenomena that is a non-thing is like a subcategory of established base. Phenomena that are non-things are permanent phenomena. So that's okay. Like a subcategory of
established base. You're saying that basis. Phenomena that are non-things are a subcategory of established base. Are you saying that there's nothing that is neither, or no?
No, there is something that's neither.
Okay.
Something that doesn't exist, like an angry Buddha or a ruling king of America or a rabbit's horn.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So do you feel fairly confident with that? Do you want to do another one? Okay. Established bases and non-things. Okay. So why don't you start then?
This is the one I tried to do last week out of the top of my head. Mm-hmm. I had to work out a lot of things because I had some things that don't make sense that I want to ask you about in this whole thing. Mm-hmm. Okay, this one is four possibilities without anything that's neither. So there are four possibilities between established bases and non-things without anything that is neither. Something that's both.
You have to establish that they're different phenomena. But
not
first.
In the way they write it in the book. I just took the format. I just took exactly what they have in the book. They didn't use that for this. They only use that for.
Doesn't have that for mutually inclusive.
But they are diverse. Oh. They are different because they are diverse.
First. Okay.
That I accept. Something that is both an established base and a non-thing is the subject nirvana. The subject nirvana is an established base because of being that which is established by a reliable cognizer. Subject nirvana is a non-thing because of being that which is empty of the ability to perform a function. Something that is an established base, but number two, something that is an established base but not a non-thing is the subject, my hand. The subject, my hand, is an established base because of being that which is established by a reliable cognizer. The subject, my hand, is not a non-thing because of being a functional thing. Mm-hmm. It works for you?
Mm-hmm.
It works for me. But I have questions about this. So,
okay,
number three. Is something that is a non-thing but not an established base is the subject of rabbit's horn. The subject of rabbit's horn is a non-thing because of being non-existent. And non-things includes both phenomena that are non-things and non-existence. the subject of rabbit's horn is not an established base because of being an, because of not being an existent, or because of not being a knowable object. So can I ask you some questions about this whole thing?
Mm-hmm.
Something in here seems so arbitrary to me. One is, why is it that you can't compare a non-existent with an existent, but you can use an non-existent as an example when you do these? The basic question you start with is, how do these two things compare? And you have to compare two existents. But then when you go through this thing, they allow you to bring in non-existence mm-hmm. to get to this thing of, is there something that's neither or not?
I
just think it's like my mind goes like, okay, just do it because that's the answer.
Wait a minute.
I can see it the way we draw it up on the board.
When you're doing four possibilities and three possibilities, you're not restricted to things being existence. When you're doing mutually exclusive and mutually inclusive, you are. Oh, I see. Okay.
The only way it makes sense to me is because when we started off the whole shebang, we started with the selfless, and we had two like categories there of existence and non-existence.
Right.
Because of the way they define that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just seems so arbitrary to me that you can do it when you would do. You can't use a non-existence when you do the comparison, but then you can bring in the examples. It's just like, why?
Anybody have any ideas?
What comes to my mind is that he made a very strong case that you can't compare something that doesn't have characteristics or instances. So that seems obvious. But the fact that they can be included is because they're selfless. Even a non-existent... Right.
Yeah.
Even a non-existence is selfless, so then it can be an example of a selfless that's not existent.
I'm confused. I thought it would be established base and non-things are mutually exclusive because non-things are non-existence. I thought established bases and non-things are mutually exclusive because it's not phenomena that are non-things, it's just non-things.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about that too. The category of non-things has both existent and non-existent in it. Yeah. But existence trumps non-existent, doesn't it? In the same way that permanent trumps impermanent.
Mm-hmm.
So the category non-things is an existent. But everything that is a non-thing isn't necessarily existent. Okay. Now try again.
One of the problems with this one is the way they defined.
So non-things means everything that's not a functioning thing, not a impermanent phenomena. So that can include permanent phenomena as well as things that don't exist.
But what's crazy about that is the way they defined non-thing in this very text. Mm-hmm. They define non-thing as a phenomena which does not perform a function. So that really confused me.
Oh, yeah. It shouldn't be defined.
It is defined that way, but it still works for this.
No.
It is defined that way.
That's not what they're defining. They're defining phenomena and non-thing.
No. Look at non-thing in the definitions. And it will say a phenomena that is not unable to perform a function. But this very
really?
Book has all the answers.
Oh.
And the answer to this question is on page 54, and he says it's four possibilities without neither, exactly what we did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe his definition was not correct, because a non-thing is anything that's not a thing, so it includes both permanent and non-existence. So to say the definition is a phenomenon which is not a thing is actually a wrong definition.
If you look on page 478, where they have all the charts, all the definitions, it says phenomenon that is a non-thing. So it doesn't just say non-thing. It's just phenomenon that is a non-thing.
Yeah.
So that means
phenomena which is a non-thing and non-thing are different.
Right. I agree.
Okay. Why don't we do a comparison of non-thing and phenomena, which are non-things? Yeah? Okay. So let's do it. You want it? So non-thing and phenomena that are non-things. What are they?
I think they're 3P.
Uh-huh.
So something that is both a non-thing and a phenomena, which is a non-thing, would be the subject uncompounded space.
Mm-hmm.
Uncompounded space is a phenomena, which is a non-thing, because it is empty of being able to perform a function.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have a definition of just non-thing, do we? I don't think.
Yeah, we do. Anything that's not a thing.
Okay, yes, okay. And the subject, uncompounded space, is a non-thing because it's not a functioning thing.
Yeah.
It's not a thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Then something that is so the pervasion. Whatever is a phenomena that is a non-thing is necessarily a non-thing, but whatever is a non-thing is not necessarily phenomena, which is a non-thing.
Uh-huh.
For example, the horns of a rabbit.
Mm-hmm.
The horns of a rabbit is not a phenomena, which is a non-thing, because it's not an existent. And the subject, horns of a rabbit, is a non-thing because it's a non-functioning. It's not a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's, yeah. Or because it's not an impermanent. Or no, it's not a permanent phenomena. Which one are we on?
Why is it a non-thing? So horns of a rabbit is a non-thing because it's a non-existent.
Because it's a non-existent.
Yeah, and there's nothing which is neither.
But is a horn of a rabbit a phenomena? It's not a phenomena which is a non-thing.
Uh-huh.
But it is a non-thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there is something that is neither.
Oh.
You are something that is neither.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes. Yes. Right. Okay. There is something which is neither.
Yeah. So the example, Venerable Seipal.
Venerable Tarpa's hand. Yeah. Any impermanent phenomena would do. Okay. So Venerable Tarpa's hand is the subject. Venerable Tarpa's hand is not a phenomena which is a non-thing because it's a thing,
mm-hmm.
And Venerable Tarpa's hand is. The subject, Venerable Tarpa's hand, is not a non-thing because it's a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to address Venerable Tarpa's qualm about why we can't compare phenomena, but then that are, why we can't compare, use a non-existent when we compare two things,
mm-hmm.
but we can use a non-existent in as an example.
Uh-huh.
The first is because it doesn't work. It doesn't work to compare if it's a non-existent because it doesn't have any qualities.
Yeah.
But it does work to use it as an example. And I think that's simply it. One doesn't work and the other does work. And because it does work to use it as an example, there's no reason to bar it. Yeah, but you could say, you could be comparing Fords and vehicles, and something that is neither could be a rock, but it could also be a horn of a rabbit. It doesn't have to be involved with selfless at that point.
I think he's right that you don't have to include the selfless part, that it's just that it's non-cow is going to include everything that isn't a cow. So it doesn't matter. Well, it is, but it does go back to the axiom that you start with. It does go back to that initial definition, because mm-hmm. if you didn't have it included in there, you wouldn't be able to use it.
Yeah, but she's saying it's included in there because we have the big category that says selfless. Yeah, so, I mean, both things come down to the same point. Okay, so does that answer your question? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. How are people doing? You want to do another one? Somebody want to make up one?
So I made up one. How do the two compare? People who make ethical mistakes and people who are competent at their job.
Ah, very good. Okay, now it's going to be interesting which category you put Kavanaugh in.
Okay, so someone that is both, four possibilities.
Okay.
Oh, I didn't think about neither. whether there's something that's neither.
So yes. List your two things again so we have
okay.
them clear.
People They're both, who,
are they both persons or?
Yes. What? So people who, I said make ethical mistakes, but maybe a better way would be to say act unethically.
Or create non-virtue?
Yeah.
Is that easier?
Sure. Okay. Create non-virtue.
Okay.
And people competent at their job.
Okay.
So there are four possibilities between people who create non-virtue and people who are competent at their job. So someone who is who both creates non-virtue and is competent at their job is someone who puts poison in at their office to kill mice, but is otherwise good at their job. Mm-hmm. So this has happened at a place where I worked before. Someone who puts poison to kill rats creates non-virtue because killing is non-virtuous. And someone who...
You have to list the whole subject. You can't really say someone who kills rats. It's somebody who kills rats who performs well at their job. Mm-hmm. You have to put the whole thing in to be a subject.
Okay, so someone who kills rats but is competent at their job is competent because they own the business and the business is doing well. An example?
Oh, okay.
I guess the owner of the business where I worked is an example. I won't name them. Okay, so then someone who creates non-virtue but is not competent at their job is a person who breaks laws but is supposed to uphold ethical and legal principles. For example, who's been convicted? Richard Nixon. So Richard Nixon creates non-virtue and is not competent at his job because he lied about his role in illegally monitoring the election.
No, the Watergate break-in.
Yeah, Watergate. So Richard Nixon makes ethical or creates non-virtue and is, I'm mixed up now, and is not competent.
It's good to write them down and then point. It helps you stay focused. Yeah.
Okay. So first.
So start with again with something that's someone that's both.
The director of a nonprofit in a rat-infested building.
Who kills the rats?
This is where it was.
Okay.
You kill rats?
Yeah.
And then what makes him competent in his job?
Because the business had been around for like 20-plus years.
No, that doesn't mean that the person's competent.
He had a lot of background in that field.
Somebody met the goals of the organization?
Yeah, or he met the job, he performed the job description characteristics, he met those?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. The employees agreed he was performing well.
That doesn't mean somebody's doing well at their job. An exterminator who meets the customer's expectations.
Yeah,
it can't be any old exterminator. Okay, then?
Okay, so one but not two?
Mm-hmm.
That would be an example is an honest person who is untrained in their profession.
No, something that is one, but
oh,
not two.
Sorry, that'd be the other one.
Okay.
Okay, so that would be...
Yeah. Or yeah. You could just say an unemployed crook. Yeah. Because he creates non-virtue, but he doesn't have a job, so he can't be competent at a job. Yeah.
How about a hunter? Wait, that's...
Does he have a job? An unemployed hunter.
A bad hunter.
An unemployed sex offender.
I think
we've listed a bunch of them, but you haven't written any of them down.
Okay, Lars Waver, she is your show.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, a doctor who is addicted to some kind of drug. And
Does that mean he's not good at his job?
Yeah, he's not.
That would be both.
He doesn't perform well. He.
But what about the times when he's not on the drug?
Yeah. He's always on it.
Is that okay with you?
Yeah, that's good.
Okay. Then do something that's two but not one.
I would say a hunter.
Ah. The Buddha.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Competent doctor.
Yeah.
Buddha.
Has to be an Arya. Then why is the Buddha one and why is the Buddha not... I mean, why is the Buddha number two and why is it not number one?
He's able to lead sentient beings to liberation, which is his goal, what he wants to do, and then he doesn't create non-virtue because he has no afflictions in his mind stream.
What's the definition of job? Does a Buddha have a job? Yeah? Does he have a social security number?
Someone's that's neither. An untrained Arya mechanic.
Yeah, or a cat.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. No.
Yeah, cat.
By people, are you referring to human beings? Or yeah. Yeah, so table would work.
How about an Arya who doesn't know how to fix cars? Works at a mechanic store.
An Arya mechanic who doesn't know how to fix cars? How'd you get that job? Okay. Yeah, but you see, this is why it's good to do it, because then you can really get a sense of how it's done. Yeah, so you only learn how to do it by making mistakes. So that's okay.
Topic of mutual inclusion. I mean, Em and I had a question this morning about like why a term like existent has so many synonyms. Like, is it meant to help us to think about different aspects of the same thing?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, because that has so many different, each synonym has a different definition, which makes you kind of understand more better what it is. Yeah, but that's a good question. Yeah.
Compare Arya Buddha and Buddha?
Oh, that's a good one. Yes. Arya Buddha and Buddha.
Okay.
So you have to remember what we learned in Precious Garland.
3P, including neither. So there are three possibilities between Arya Buddha and Buddha.
How many P did you say?
Three. 3P.
Mm-hmm.
So, something that is both a P and a Q is the subject. So, something that's both an Arya Buddha and a Buddha is the subject Shakyamuni Buddha. The subject Shakyamuni Buddha is an Arya Buddha because he is a person who is fully awakened. The subject Shakyamuni Buddha is a Buddha because he has the physical characteristics, compassion, and wisdom of a Buddha. Second one, whatever is a P is necessarily a Q. Whatever is a whatever is an Arya Buddha is necessarily a Buddha, But whatever is a Buddha is not necessarily an Arya Buddha. So the subject, the nature, truth, body of a Buddha is a Buddha because it is part of the characteristics of a Buddha. The subject, the nature, truth, body is not an Arya Buddha because it's not a person.
Mm-hmm.
And then three, something that is neither an Arya Buddha nor a Buddha is the subject, upekkha. The subject.
Are you sure?
The subject, I'm not sure. So Venerable Tarpa will be raising her hand in a minute. The subject, upekkha, is not an Arya Buddha because he's not yet fully awakened. The subject, upekkha, is not a Buddha because he has not removed all the afflictive and cognitive obscurations in his mental continuum.
Would two be called a Buddha or just Buddha?
A Buddha would be an Arya Buddha, and Buddha is just Buddha. Yeah, there's no A or the before it. Okay, we just have a few minutes left, so I don't know. Do you want to start the next chapter? Read a little bit? Okay, so consciousnesses in relation to what they perceive. So in a meditative tradition such as Buddhism, the topic of consciousness is of the highest importance. And in a tradition such as Buddhism that holds that we will be liberated through accurately understanding the nature of what exists, there is considerable reflection on the value of individual consciousnesses in regard to whether or not these consciousnesses are reliable observers of the real world. Okay. So this system believes in a real world. Okay. They say things are truly existent, so they are real, they are objectively existent. Okay, so that's why we have that sentence. Although everyone will benefit from increasing their skill in analytical thinking, the Buddhist descriptions of what exists, including the descriptions of consciousness, is of little value if one does not reflect on those descriptions. Okay, so again, this whole thing of it's not about intellectual learning, it's about taking what we learn and identifying these things in our own experience. In a way, it is easy to reflect on the nature of mind because it is always with us, so we can do it anytime, anywhere. In another way, it is difficult because the mind is always with us and it is hard to pay attention to what is always there. That's not the only reason why it's difficult. It's because the mind is usually filled with external objects, so it's hard to isolate what is the mind and pay attention just to the mind. Okay. The Buddhists offer detailed descriptions of sense and mental consciousnesses that are geared mainly towards weighing the value of those consciousnesses in accurately engaging their objects. Thus, those descriptions can have real value for all persons who care to measure the reliability of their thoughts and perceptions. This implies that reflection on these Buddhist descriptions of consciousness might be beneficial. If they aren't beneficial, why in the world are we studying them? Okay. So, it's talking, you know, when we read all these things, it's just so important to think this is an explanation of my mind. It's not just an explanation of something that's out there that we're studying like a specimen, okay? But this is telling me what my mind is like. So that means I have to look inside and be able to identify all these different kinds of minds and all these different kinds of characteristics. Yeah. And it's not always easy, you know, for that reason, because our mind is usually all over the place. It may be difficult to take the full measure of what is meant by the definition of consciousness as that which is clear and knowing. However, much of the layout of consciousnesses is easily right at hand, equally within the experience of everyone. Charles Sanders Peirce said, "I think of consciousness as a bottomless lake whose waters seem transparent, yet to which we can clearly see but a little way." And that's quite true. The descriptions of consciousness given in this meditative tradition will assist most anyone in sorting out some measure of what is going on and would have helped Professor Pierce see clearly a little bit deeper. Thus, I encourage everyone to spend some time reflecting on these descriptions by watching with a mindful sliver of your own thought the flow of consciousness as you go through your day. So recall from Chapter 10, Basic Buddhist Ontology 2, that in the division of functioning things into matter, consciousness, and abstract composites, consciousness is mutually inclusive with awareness and knower. In fact, a knower and an awareness have the relationship of a definition to a definiendum, for a knower is the definition of an awareness. Also, since the definition of consciousness is that which is clear and knowing, and each definiendum is mutually inclusive with its own definition, these four, awareness, knower, consciousness, and that which is clear and knowing, I think you have to say that which is clear and knowing, are all mutually inclusive with each other. Recall that the primary division of consciousnesses is into two types, mental consciousness and sense consciousness. So remember, that is his way of dividing it. There's other ways where it's into primary minds and mental factors. Thus, the four mutually inclusive phenomena above begin with awareness and are all 3P with mental consciousness and with sense consciousness, as well as with each of the individual sense consciousnesses, like the ear consciousness. Okay, so let's go through and make sure that's true. So go through, compare sense consciousness and that which is clear and knowing.
Okay, there's three possibilities between that which is clear and knowing and sense consciousness. Something that is both clear and knowing and sense consciousness would be an eye sense consciousness, perceiving blue. Do I have to go through all the reasons?
Sure.
Okay. It's a sense consciousness because it arises independence on a physical sense power. And it's that which is clearing knowing because it's an awareness. It's a consciousness. Whatever is a sense consciousness is necessarily that which is clearing knowing, but that which is clear in knowing is not necessarily a sense consciousness. For example, a dream consciousness mm-hmm. is clear and knowing, but is not a sense consciousness because it doesn't arise from a sense faculty. It arises from the mental faculty.
And then neither?
Something which is neither would be the whiteboard.
Yeah. Okay, good. There is no overlap between mental consciousness and sense consciousnesses. For there is no consciousness that is both a mental consciousness and a sense consciousness. Clear to everybody? Thus, mental consciousnesses and sense consciousnesses are mutually exclusive, but every individual consciousness is either a mental consciousness or a sense consciousness. The Buddha isn't a consciousness. He isn't a consciousness. A person is not a consciousness. Okay. You can't just say the Dharma. You have to say the wisdom Dharmakaya. Okay. So is the wisdom Dharmakaya a mental consciousness? It contains both. Both mental consciousnesses and sense consciousnesses.
Mind sees everything.
Everything, right? Yeah. No, they say they're still different. They say that each consciousness is omniscient, but each consciousness is still different.
But the sense consciousness, they all do the jobs of all the other ones.
Right, but they remain distinct.
Okay, so they're distinct, but if they're doing the jobs of the different ones, then he's having a mental consciousness with a sense consciousness. No?
No, they don't say each consciousness of a Buddha is a distinct one, even though they do the same thing.
So can't his mental consciousness see that which is suitable as a form?
So, yes, and his eye consciousness can see what is form, but that doesn't mean those two consciousnesses are the same.
But I think you're mixing up schools here because I don't think Sotrantika accepts omniscience.
Yeah, well, they don't even talk about omniscient mind in the same way. Yeah.
I think, yeah, an omniscient can know one thing at a time, but not everything at the same time.
Right.
I think that's the Hinayana.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All-knowing.
Anyway, they have a different explanation about the Buddha's mind, so yeah. This probably wouldn't.
But we can mix the schools a little bit when we want to. I mean, we're using an example, so yeah.
No, but if this is a pervasion that mental consciousness and sense consciousnesses are mutually exclusive, you do run into problems when you talk about the omniscient mind of a Buddha.
No, they say that they're still individual consciousnesses, even though each one is omniscient. It would be.
But how could you distinguish a mental consciousness and a sense consciousness in the mind of a Buddha?
Because somehow they distinguish them. They don't want to say. they don't want to say that all the consciousnesses are the same. So they would say a sense consciousness is a sense consciousness, but it's an omniscient sense consciousness. And a mental consciousness is a mental consciousness, and it's also omniscient. But that doesn't mean that the Buddha's sense consciousness is the Buddha's mental consciousness. It's just the way they talk about it. You know, like when they talk about the two knowers, the knower, what is it, the one that sees the mode and the one that sees diversity. So they're both omniscient, but they're distinct consciousnesses. You can't say the one that perceives the diversity is the one that perceives the mode. They're distinct consciousnesses, but they're both omniscient. That's what they say. Yeah, go ask a Buddha. Yeah. Yeah.
Does that mean that the Buddha's ear consciousness hears everything that can be heard, but his eye consciousness sees everything that can be seen?
Yeah, or does his eye consciousness can also hear everything that can be heard.
So it's not dependent on its own uncommon power.
No.
So this is a totally different class than what we're talking about.
Yeah, it's very different. It's kind of the same way that they say two people can be Buddhas, but that doesn't mean, you know, that they're the same person. Okay, so you can have two people that are omniscient. You know, Joe and Kathy are both omniscient. But Joe isn't Kathy and Kathy isn't Joe because they have different social security. Yeah, and they have different driver's licenses. Okay, so I think we can stop here and then start with thought consciousnesses and direct perceivers next week. So these kinds of ways of, you know, asking yourself to compare stuff is very, very helpful for understanding what things are, because otherwise we just kind of, sometimes we can really mush stuff together, but this makes us really ask ourselves what things are.
What about actions? Are actions abstract components?
Oh, some actions are form, according to Prasangika and Vivasika. Yeah, so some are form, and walking would be an action that's form also. Walking, you can see it with your eyes. Killing somebody is an action that is form. Okay, intended actions are the actions that are mental actions, right? Because you have, oh, intention and intended. Okay, so intended actions, they're going to be formed because they're actions of body and speech.